He writes, I may augur from the silence of my family that they object to the resolution I have taken, but I should not allow myself to be swerved from the path of duty, Mr. Copperfield, even by my papa and mamma, were they still living. I expressed my opinion that this was going in the right direction. It may be a sacrifice, said Mrs. Micawber, to immure oneself in a cathedral town. But surely, Mr. Copperfield, if it is a sacrifice in me, it is much more a sacrifice in a man of Mr. Micawber's abilities. Oh, you're going to a cathedral town, said I. Mr. Micawber, who had been helping us all out of the wash-handstand jug, replied, To Canterbury. In fact, my dear Copperfield, I have entered into arrangements by virtue of which I stand pledged and contracted to our friend Heap, to assist and serve him in the capacity of, and to be his confidential clerk. I stared at Mr. Micawber, who greatly enjoyed my surprise. I am bound to state to you, he said with an official air, that the business habits and the prudent suggestions of Mrs. Micawber have in a great measure conduced to this result. The gauntlet, to which Mrs. Micawber referred upon a former occasion, being thrown down in the form of an advertisement, was taken up by my friend Heap and led to a mutual recognition. Of my friend Heap, said Mr. Micawber, who is a man of remarkable shrewdness, I desire to speak with all possible respect. My friend Heap has not fixed the positive remuneration at too high a figure, but he has made a great deal in the way of extrication from the pressure of pecuniary difficulties contingent on the value of my services, and on the value of those services I pin my faith. Such address and intelligence as I chance to possess, said Mr. Micawber, boastfully disparaging himself with the old genteel air, will be devoted to my friend Heap's service. I have already some acquaintance with the law, as a defendant on civil process, and I shall immediately apply myself to the commentaries of one of the most eminent and remarkable of our English jurists. I believe it is unnecessary to add that I allude to Mr. Justice Blackstone. These observations, and indeed the greater part of the observations made that evening, were interrupted by Mrs. Micawber's discovering that Master Micawber was sitting on his boots, or holding his head on with both arms as if he felt it loose, or accidentally kicking Traddles under the table, or shuffling his feet over one another, or producing them at distances from himself apparently outrageous to nature, or lying sideways with his hair among the wine glasses, or developing his restlessness of limb in some other form incompatible with the general interests of society, and by Master Micawber's receiving those discoveries in a resentful spirit. I sat all the while amazed by Mr. Micawber's disclosure, and wondering what it meant, until Mrs. Micawber resumed the thread of the discourse and claimed my attention. What I particularly request Mr. Micawber to be careful of is, said Mrs. Micawber, that he does not, my dear Mr. Copperfield, in applying himself to this subordinate branch of the law, place it out of his power to rise ultimately to the top of the tree. I am convinced that Mr. Micawber, giving his mind to a profession so adapted to his fertile resources and his flow of language, must distinguish himself. Now, for example, Mr. Traddles, said Mrs. Micawber, assuming a profound air, a judge, or even, say, a chancellor. Does an individual place himself beyond the pale of those preferments by entering on such an office as Mr. Micawber has accepted? My dear, observed Mr. Micawber, but glancing inquisitively at Traddles too, we have time enough before us for the consideration of those questions. Micawber, she returned, no. Your mistake in life is that you do not look forward far enough. You are bound, in justice to your family, if not to yourself, to take in at a comprehensive glance the extremest point in the horizon to which your abilities may lead you. Mr. Micawber coughed, and drank his punch with an air of exceeding satisfaction, still glancing at Traddles as if he desired to have his opinion. "Why, the plain state of the case, Mrs. Micawber," said Traddles, mildly breaking the truth to her. "I mean the real, prosaic fact, you know."
"Just so," said Mrs. Micawber. "My dear Mr. Traddles, I wish to be as prosaic and literal as possible on a subject of so much importance."
"Is," said Traddles, "that this branch of the law, even if Mr. Micawber were a regular solicitor..."
"Exactly so," returned Mrs. Micawber. "Wilkins, you're squinting, and you'll not be able to get your eyes back."
"Has nothing," pursued Traddles, "to do with that. Only a barrister is eligible for such preferments, and Mr. Micawber could not be a barrister without being entered at an inn of court as a student for 5 years."
"Do I follow you?" said Mrs. Micawber, with her most affable air of business. "Do I understand, my dear Mr. Traddles, that at the expiration of that period, Mr. Micawber would be eligible as a judge or chancellor?"
"He would be eligible," returned Traddles, with a strong emphasis on that word.
"Thank you," said Mrs. Micawber. "That is quite sufficient. If such is the case, and Mr. Micawber forfeits no privilege by entering on these duties, my anxiety is set at rest." "I speak," said Mrs. Micawber, "as a female, necessarily, but I have always been of opinion that Mr. Micawber possesses what I have heard my papa call, when I lived at home, the judicial mind, and I hope Mr. Micawber is now entering on a field where that mind will develop itself and take a commanding station."
I quite believe that Mr. Micawber saw himself, in his judicial mind's eye, on the woolsack. He passed his hand complacently over his bald head and said with ostentatious resignation, "My dear, we will not anticipate the decrees of fortune. If I am reserved to wear a wig, I am at least prepared externally," in allusion to his baldness, "for that distinction."
"I do not," said Mr. Micawber, "regret my hair. I may have been deprived of it for a specific purpose. I cannot say. It is my intention, my dear Copperfield, to educate my son for the church. I will not deny that I should be happy on his account to attain to eminence."
"For the church?" said I, still pondering between whiles on Uriah Heep.
"Yes," said Mr. Micawber. "He has a remarkable head voice and will commence as a chorister. Our residence at Canterbury and our local connection will no doubt enable him to take advantage of any vacancy that may arise in the cathedral corps."
On looking at Master Micawber again, I saw that he had a certain expression of face, as if his voice were behind his eyebrows, where it presently appeared to be, on his singing us as an alternative between that and bed, the woodpecker tapping. After many compliments on this performance, we fell into some general conversation, and as I was too full of my desperate intentions to keep my altered circumstances to myself, I made them known to Mr. and Mrs. Micawber. I cannot express how extremely delighted they both were by the idea of my aunt's being in difficulties, and how comfortable and friendly it made them. When we were nearly come to the last round of the punch, I addressed myself to Traddles, and reminded him that we must not separate without wishing our friends health, happiness, and success in their new career. I begged Mr. Micawber to fill us bumpers, and proposed the toast in due form, shaking hands with him across the table, and kissing Mrs. Micawber to commemorate that eventful occasion. Traddles imitated me in the first particular, but did not consider himself a sufficiently old friend to venture on the second.
"My dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, rising with one of his thumbs in each of his waistcoat pockets, "the companion of my youth, if I may be allowed the expression, and my esteemed friend Traddles, if I may be permitted to call him so, will allow me, on the part of Mrs. Micawber, myself, and our offspring, to thank them in the warmest and most uncompromising terms for their good wishes. It may be expected that, on the eve of a migration which will consign us to a perfectly new existence," Mr. Micawber spoke as if they were going 500,000 miles, "I should offer a few valedictory remarks to two such friends as I see before me. But all that I have to say in this way I have said. Whatever station in society I may attain, through the medium of the learned profession of which I am about to become an unworthy member, I shall endeavour not to disgrace, and Mrs. Micawber will be safe to adorn. Under the temporary pressure of pecuniary liabilities, contracted with a view to their immediate liquidation but remaining unliquidated through a combination of circumstances, I have been under the necessity of assuming a garb from which my natural instincts recoil, I allude to spectacles, and possessing myself of a cognomen to which I can establish no legitimate pretensions. All I have to say on that score is that the cloud has passed from the dreary scene, and the god of day is once more high upon the mountain tops. On Monday next, on the arrival of the 4 o'clock afternoon coach at Canterbury, my foot will be on my native heath, my name Micawber." Mr. Micawber resumed his seat on the close of these remarks, and drank 2 glasses of punch in grave succession. He then said with much solemnity, "One thing more I have to do before this separation is complete, and that is to perform an act of justice. My friend, Mr. Thomas Traddles, has, on 2 several occasions, put his name, if I may use a common expression, to bills of exchange for my accommodation. On the first occasion, Mr. Thomas Traddles was left, let me say, in short, in the lurch. The fulfilment of the second has not yet arrived. The amount of the first obligation," here Mr. Micawber carefully referred to papers, "was, I believe, 23,499½. Of the second, according to my entry of that transaction, 18,662. These sums, united, make a total, if my calculation is correct, amounting to 41,10,11½. My friend Copperfield will perhaps do me the favour to check that total." I did so, and found it correct. "To leave this metropolis," said Mr. Micawber, "and my friend Mr. Thomas Traddles, without acquitting myself of the pecuniary part of this obligation, would weigh upon my mind to an insupportable extent. I have therefore prepared for my friend Mr. Thomas Traddles, and I now hold in my hand, a document which accomplishes the desired object. I beg to hand to my friend Mr. Thomas Traddles my IOU for 41,10,11½, and I am happy to recover my moral dignity and to know that I can once more walk erect before my fellow man." With this introduction, which greatly affected him, Mr. Micawber placed his IOU in the hands of Traddles and said he wished him well in every relation of life. I am persuaded not only that this was quite the same to Mr. Micawber as paying the money, but that Traddles himself hardly knew the difference until he had had time to think about it. Mr. Micawber walked so erect before his fellow man on the strength of this virtuous action that his chest looked half as broad again when he lighted us downstairs. We parted with great heartiness on both sides, and when I'd seen Traddles to his own door and was going home alone, I thought, among the other odd and contradictory things I mused upon, that, slippery as Mr. Micawber was, I was probably indebted to some compassionate recollection he retained of me as his boy lodger for never having been asked by him for money. I certainly shouldn't have had the moral courage to refuse it. And I've no doubt he knew that. To his credit be it written, quite as well as I did. Chapter 37. A Little Cold Water. My new life had lasted for more than a week, and I was stronger than ever in those tremendous practical resolutions that I felt the crisis required. I continued to walk extremely fast and to have a general idea that I was getting on. I made it a rule to take as much out of myself as I possibly could in my way of doing everything to which I applied my energies. I made a perfect victim of myself. I even entertained some idea of putting myself on a vegetable diet, vaguely conceiving that, in becoming a graminivorous animal, I should sacrifice to Dora. As yet, little Dora was quite unconscious of my desperate firmness, otherwise than as my letters darkly shadowed it forth. But another Saturday came, and on that Saturday evening she was to be at Miss Mills's, and when Mr. Mills had gone to his whist club, telegraphed to me in the street by a birdcage in the drawing-room middle window, I was to go there to tea. By this time we were quite settled down in Buckingham Street, where Mr. Dick continued his copying in a state of absolute felicity. My aunt had obtained a signal victory over Mrs. Crupp by paying her off, throwing the first pitcher she planted on the stairs out of window, and protecting in person up and down the staircase a supernumerary whom she engaged from the outer world. These vigorous measures struck such terror to the breast of Mrs. Crupp that she subsided into her own kitchen under the impression that my aunt was mad. My aunt, being supremely indifferent to Mrs. Crupp's opinion and everybody else's, and rather favouring than discouraging the idea, Mrs. Crupp, of late the bold, became within a few days so faint-hearted that rather than encounter my aunt upon the staircase, she would endeavour to hide her portly form behind doors, leaving visible, however, a wide margin of flannel petticoat, or would shrink into dark corners. This gave my aunt such unspeakable satisfaction that I believe she took a delight in prowling up and down with her bonnet insanely perched on the top of her head at times when Mrs. Crupp was likely to be in the way. My aunt, being uncommonly neat and ingenious, made so many little improvements in our domestic arrangements that I seemed to be richer instead of poorer. Among the rest, she converted the pantry into a dressing-room for me, and purchased and embellished a bedstead for my occupation, which looked as like a bookcase in the daytime as a bedstead could. I was the object of her constant solicitude, and my poor mother herself couldn't have loved me better or studied more how to make me happy. Peggotty had considered herself highly privileged in being allowed to participate in these labours, and although she still retained something of her old sentiment of awe in reference to my aunt, had received so many marks of encouragement and confidence that they were the best friends possible. But the time had now come, I am speaking of the Saturday when I was to take tea at Miss Mills's, when it was necessary for her to return home and enter on the discharge of the duties she had undertaken in behalf of Ham. "So good-bye, Barkis," said my aunt, "and take care of yourself. I'm sure I never thought I could be sorry to lose you." I took Peggotty to the coach office and saw her off. She cried at parting, and confided her brother to my friendship as Ham had done. We'd heard nothing of him since he went away that sunny afternoon. "And now, my own dear Davy," said Peggotty, "if, while you're apprentice, you should want any money to spend, or if, when you're out of your time, my dear, you should want any to set you up, and you must do one or other or both, my darling, who has such a good right to ask leave to lend it to you as my sweet girl's own old stupid me?" I was not so savagely independent as to say anything in reply, but that if ever I borrowed money of any one, I would borrow it of her. Next to accepting a large sum on the spot, I believe this gave Peggotty more comfort than anything I could have done. "And, my dear," whispered Peggotty, "tell the pretty little angel that I should so have liked to see her only for a minute, and tell her that before she marries my boy, I'll come and make your house so beautiful for you if you let me." I declared that nobody else should touch it. And this gave Peggotty such delight that she went away in good spirits. I fatigued myself as much as I possibly could in the Commons all day by a variety of devices, and at the appointed time in the evening repaired to Mr. Mills's street. Mr. Mills, who was a terrible fellow to fall asleep after dinner, hadn't yet gone out, and there was no birdcage in the middle window. He kept me waiting so long that I fervently hoped the club would fine him for being late. At last he came out, and then I saw my own Dora hang up the birdcage and peep into the balcony to look for me and run in again when she saw I was there, while Jip remained behind to bark injuriously at an immense butcher's dog in the street who could have taken him like a pill. Dora came to the drawing-room door to meet me, and Jip came scrambling out, tumbling over his own growls, under the impression that I was a bandit. And we all three went in, as happy and loving as could be. I soon carried desolation into the bosom of our joys, not that I meant to do it, but that I was so full of the subject, by asking Dora, without the smallest preparation, if she could love a beggar. My pretty little startled Dora! Her only association with the word was a yellow face and a nightcap, or a pair of crutches, or a wooden leg, or a dog with a decanter stand in his mouth, or something of that kind. And she stared at me with the most delightful wonder. "How can you ask me anything so foolish?" pouted Dora. "Love a beggar!" "Dora, my own dearest," said I, "I am a beggar." "How can you be such a silly thing?" replied Dora, slapping my hand, "as to sit there telling such stories. I'll make Jip bite you." Her childish way was the most delicious way in the world to me, but it was necessary to be explicit, and I solemnly repeated, "Dora, my own life, I am your ruined David." "I declare I'll make Jip bite you," said Dora, shaking her curls, "if you're so ridiculous." But I looked so serious that Dora left off shaking her curls and laid her trembling little hand upon my shoulder, and first looked scared and anxious, then began to cry. That was dreadful. I fell upon my knees before the sofa, caressing her and imploring her not to rend my heart. But for some time poor little Dora did nothing but exclaim, "Oh dear, oh dear," and "Oh, she was so frightened," and "Where was Julia Mills?" and "Oh, take her to Julia Mills and go away, please," until I was almost beside myself. At last, after an agony of supplication and protestation, I got Dora to look at me with a horrified expression of face, which I gradually soothed until it was only loving, and her soft, pretty cheek was lying against mine. Then I told her, with my arms clasped round her, how I loved her so dearly and so dearly, how I felt it right to offer to release her from her engagement because now I was poor, how I never could bear it or recover it if I lost her, how I had no fears of poverty if she had none, my arm being nerved and my heart inspired by her, how I was already working with a courage such as none but lovers knew, how I had begun to be practical and to look into the future, how a crust well-earned was sweeter far than a feast inherited, and much more to the same purpose, which I delivered in a burst of passionate eloquence, quite surprising to myself, though I'd been thinking about it day and night ever since my aunt had astonished me. "Is your heart mine still, dear Dora?" said I rapturously, for I knew by her clinging to me that it was. "Oh, yes," cried Dora. "Oh, yes, it's all yours. Oh, don't be dreadful." "I dreadful? To Dora? Don't talk about being poor and working hard," said Dora, nestling closer to me. "Oh, don't, don't!" "My dearest love," said I, "the crust well earned." "Oh, yes, but I don't want to hear any more about crusts," said Dora. "And Jip must have a mutton chop every day at 12 or he'll die." I was charmed with her childish, winning way. I fondly explained to Dora that Jip should have his mutton chop with his accustomed regularity. I drew a picture of our frugal home made independent by my labour, sketching in the little house I'd seen at Highgate and my aunt in her room upstairs. "I'm not dreadful now, Dora," said I tenderly. "Oh, no, no," cried Dora. "But I hope your aunt will keep in her own room a good deal, and I hope she's not a scolding old thing." If it were possible for me to love Dora more than ever, I'm sure I did. But I felt she was a little impracticable. It damped my newborn ardour to find that ardour so difficult of communication to her. I made another trial. When she was quite herself again and was curling Gypsy ears as he lay upon her lap, I became grave and said, "My own, may I mention something?" "Oh, please, don't be practical," said Dora coaxingly, "because it frightens me so." "Sweetheart," I returned, "there is nothing to alarm you in all this. I want you to think of it quite differently. I want to make it nerve you and inspire you, Dora."
"Oh, that's so shocking," cried Dora.
"My love, no. Perseverance and strength of character will enable us to bear much worse things."
"But I haven't got any strength at all," said Dora, shaking her curls. "Have I, Jip? Oh, do kiss Jip and be agreeable."
It was impossible to resist kissing Jip when she held him up to me for that purpose, putting her own bright rosy little mouth into kissing form as she directed the operation, which she insisted should be performed symmetrically on the centre of his nose. I did as she bade me, rewarding myself afterwards for my obedience, and she charmed me out of my graver character for I don't know how long. "But, Dora, my beloved," said I, at last resuming it, "I was going to mention something. The judge of the prerogative court might have fallen in love with her, to see her fold her little hands and hold them up begging and praying me not to be dreadful any more. Indeed, I'm not going to be, my darling," I assured her. "But, Dora, my love, if you will sometimes think, not despondently, you know, far from that, but if you will sometimes think, just to encourage yourself, that you are engaged to a poor man..."
Don't, pray, don't," cried Dora. "It's so very dreadful."
"My soul, not at all," said I cheerfully. "If you will sometimes think of that, and look about now and then at your papa's housekeeping, and endeavour to acquire a little habit of accounts, for instance..." Poor little Dora received this suggestion with something that was half a sob and half a scream. "It will be so useful to us afterwards," I went on, "and if you would promise me to read a little cookery book that I would send you, it would be so excellent for both of us, for our path in life, my Dora," said I, warming with the subject, "is stony and rugged now, and it rests with us to smooth it. We must fight our way onward. We must be brave. There are obstacles to be met, and we must meet and crush them." I was going on at a great rate, with a clenched hand and a most enthusiastic countenance, but it was quite unnecessary to proceed. I had said enough. I had done it again. Oh, she was so frightened. "Oh, where was Julia Mills? Oh, take her to Julia Mills and go away, please." So that, in short, I was quite distracted and raved about the drawing-room. I thought I'd killed her this time. I sprinkled water on her face. I went down on my knees. I plucked at my hair. I denounced myself as a remorseless brute and a ruthless beast. I implored her forgiveness. I besought her to look up. I ravaged Miss Mills's workbox for a smelling bottle, and in my agony of mind applied an ivory needle case instead, and dropped all the needles over Dora. I shook my fists at Jip, who was as frantic as myself. I did every wild extravagance that could be done, and was a long way beyond the end of my wits when Miss Mills came into the room.
"Who has done this?"
exclaimed Miss Mills, succouring her friend. I replied,
"I, Miss Mills, I have done it. Behold the destroyer," or words to that effect, and hid my face from the light in the sofa cushion.
At first Miss Mills thought it was a quarrel, and that we were verging on the desert of Sahara. But she soon found out how matters stood, for my dear, affectionate Dora, embracing her, began exclaiming that I was a poor labourer, and then cried for me and embraced me and asked me would I let her give me all her money to keep, and then fell on Miss Mills's neck, sobbing as if her tender heart were broken. Miss Mills must have been born to be a blessing to us. She ascertained from me in a few words what it was all about, comforted Dora, and gradually convinced her that I was not a labourer. From my manner of stating the case, I believe Dora concluded that I was a navigator, and went balancing myself up and down a plank all day with a wheelbarrow, and so brought us together in peace. When we were quite composed, and Dora had gone upstairs to put some rose water to her eyes, Miss Mills rang for tea. In the ensuing interval I told Miss Mills that she was evermore my friend, and that my heart must cease to vibrate ere I could forget her sympathy. I then expounded to Miss Mills what I had endeavoured so very unsuccessfully to expound to Dora. Miss Mills replied on general principles that the cottage of content was better than the palace of cold splendour, and that where love was, all was. I said to Miss Mills that this was very true, and who should know it better than I, who loved Dora with a love that never mortal had experienced yet. But on Miss Mills observing with despondency that it were well indeed for some hearts if this were so, I explained that I begged leave to restrict the observation to mortals of the masculine gender. I then put it to Miss Mills to say whether she considered that there was or was not any practical merit in the suggestion I've been anxious to make concerning the accounts, the housekeeping, and the cookery book. Miss Mills, after some consideration, thus replied, "Mr. Copperfield, I will be plain with you. Mental suffering and trials supply in some natures the place of years, and I will be as plain with you as if I were a lady abbess. No. The suggestion is not appropriate to our Dora. Our dearest Dora is a favourite child of nature. She is a thing of light and airiness and joy. I am free to confess that if it could be done, it might be well, but..." And Miss Mills shook her head. I was encouraged by this closing admission on the part of Miss Mills to ask her whether, for Dora's sake, if she had any opportunity of luring her attention to such preparations for an earnest life, she would avail herself of it. Miss Mills replied in the affirmative so readily that I further asked her if she would take charge of the cookery book, and if she ever could insinuate it upon Dora's acceptance without frightening her, undertake to do me that crowning service. Miss Mills accepted this trust too, but was not sanguine. And Dora returned, looking such a lovely little creature that I really doubted whether she ought to be troubled with anything so ordinary. And she loved me so much and was so captivating, particularly when she made Jip stand on his hind legs for toast, and when she pretended to hold that nose of his against the hot teapot for punishment because he wouldn't, that I felt like a sort of monster who had got into a fairy's bower when I thought of having frightened her and made her cry. After tea, we had the guitar, and Dora sang those same dear old French songs about the impossibility of ever on any account leaving off dancing, la-la-la-la-la, until I felt a much greater monster than before. We had only one check to our pleasure, and that happened a little while before I took my leave, when, Miss Mills chancing to make some allusion to tomorrow morning, I unluckily let out that, being obliged to exert myself now, I got up at 5 o'clock. Whether Dora had any idea that I was a private watchman, I'm unable to say, but it made a great impression on her, and she neither played nor sang any more. It was still on her mind when I bade her adieu, and she said to me in her pretty, coaxing way, as if I were a doll, I used to think, "Now don't get up at 5 o'clock, you naughty boy. It's so nonsensical." "My love," said I have work to do." "But don't do it," returned Dora. "Why should you?" It was impossible to say to that sweet little surprised face, otherwise than lightly and playfully, that we must work to live. "Oh, how ridiculous," cried Dora. "How shall we live without, Dora?" said I. "How? Anyhow," said Dora. She seemed to think she'd quite settled the question. and gave me such a triumphant little kiss direct from her innocent heart that I would hardly have put her out of conceit with her answer for a fortune. Well, I loved her, and I went on loving her most absorbingly, entirely and completely, but going on to working pretty hard, and busily keeping red-hot all the irons I now had in the fire, I would sit sometimes of a night opposite my aunt, thinking how I had frightened Dora that time, and how I could best make my way with a guitar case through the forest of difficulty, until I used to fancy that my head was turning quite grey.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 17 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 18. David Copperfield, cassette 18.
Chapter 38, A Dissolution of Partnership. I did not allow my resolution with respect to the parliamentary debates to cool. It was one of the irons I began to heat immediately, and one of the irons I kept hot and hammered at with a perseverance I may honestly admire. I bought an approved scheme of the noble art and mystery of stenography, which cost me 10 and 6 pence, and plunged into a sea of perplexity that brought me, in a few weeks, to the confines of distraction. The changes that were rung upon dots, which in such a position meant such a thing, and in such another position something else entirely different. The wonderful vagaries that were played by circles. The unaccountable consequences that resulted from marks like flies' legs. The tremendous effects of a curve in a wrong place not only troubled my waking hours, but reappeared before me in my sleep. When I had groped my way blindly through these difficulties and had mastered the alphabet, which was an Egyptian temple in itself, there then appeared a procession of new horrors called arbitrary characters, the most despotic characters I've ever known. Who insisted, for instance, that a thing like the beginning of a cobweb meant expectation, and that a pen and ink skyrocket stood for disadvantageous? When I had fixed these wretches in my mind, I found that they'd driven everything else out of it. Then, beginning again, I forgot them. While I was picking them up, I dropped the other fragments of the system. In short, it was almost heartbreaking. It might have been quite heartbreaking, but for Dora, who was the stay and anchor of my tempest-driven bark. Every scratch in the scheme was a gnarled oak in the forest of difficulty, and I went on cutting them down one after another with such vigour that in 3 or 4 months I was in a condition to make an experiment on one of our crack speakers in the Commons. Shall I ever forget how the crack speaker walked off from me before I began, and left my imbecile pencil staggering about the paper as if it were in a fit? This would not do, it was quite clear. I was flying too high and should never get on so. I resorted to Traddles for advice, who suggested that he should dictate speeches to me at a pace and with occasional stoppages adapted to my weakness. Very grateful for this friendly aid, I accepted the proposal. And night after night, almost every night, for a long time, we had a sort of private parliament in Buckingham Street after I came home from the doctor's. I should like to see such a parliament anywhere else. My aunt and Mr. Dick represented the government, or the opposition, as the case might be, and Traddles, with the assistance of Enfield's speaker, or a volume of parliamentary orations, thundered astonishing invectives against them. Standing by the table, with his left forefinger on the page to keep the place, and his right arm flourishing above his head, Traddles, as Mr. Pitt, Mr. Fox, Mr. Sheridan, Mr. Burke, Lord Castlereagh, Viscount Sidmouth, or Mr. Canning, would work himself into the most violent heats, and deliver the most withering denunciations of the profligacy and corruption of my aunt and Mr. Dick. While I used to sit at a little distance with my notebook on my knee, fagging after him with all my might and main. The inconsistency and recklessness of Traddles were not to be exceeded by any real politician. He was for any description of policy in the compass of a week, and nailed all sorts of colours to every denomination of mast. My aunt, looking very like an immovable Chancellor of the Exchequer, would occasionally throw in an interruption or two as here, or no, or oh, when the text seemed to require it, which was always a signal to Mr. Dick, a perfect country gentleman, to follow lustily with the same cry. But Mr. Dick got taxed with such things in the course of his parliamentary career, and was made responsible for such awful consequences that he became uncomfortable in his mind sometimes. I believe he actually began to be afraid he really had been doing something, tending to the annihilation of the British Constitution and the ruin of the country. Often and often we pursued these debates until the clock pointed to midnight and the candles were burning down. The result of so much good practice was that, by and by, I began to keep pace with Traddles pretty well, and should have been quite triumphant if I'd had the least idea what my notes were about. But as to reading them after I got them, I might as well have copied the Chinese inscriptions on an immense collection of tea-chests, or the golden characters on all the great red and green buckles in the chemist's shops. There was nothing for it but to turn back and begin all over again. It was very hard, but I turned back, though with a heavy heart, and began laboriously and methodically to plod over the same tedious ground at a snail's pace, stopping to examine minutely every speck in the way on all sides, and making the most desperate efforts to know these elusive characters by sight wherever I met them. I was always punctual at the office, at the doctor's too, and I really did work, as the common expression is, like a cart horse. One day, when I went to the Commons as usual, I found Mr. Spenlow in the doorway looking extremely grave and talking to himself. As he was in the habit of complaining of pains in his head, he had naturally a short throat, and I do seriously believe he overstarched himself, I was at first alarmed by the idea that he was not quite right in that direction, but he soon relieved my uneasiness. Instead of returning my good morning with his usual affability, he looked at me in a distant, ceremonious manner, and coldly requested me to accompany him to a certain coffee-house, which in those days had a door opening into the Commons, just within the little archway in St. Paul's Churchyard. I complied, in a very uncomfortable state, and with a warm shooting all over me, as if my apprehensions were breaking out into buds. When I allowed him to go on a little before, on account of the narrowness of the way, I observed that he carried his head with a lofty air that was particularly unpromising, and my mind misgave me that he'd found out about my darling Dora. If I'd not guessed this on the way to the coffee-house, I could hardly have failed to know what was the matter when I followed him into an upstairs room and found Miss Murdstone there, supported by a background of sideboard, on which were several inverted tumblers sustaining lemons, and two of those extraordinary boxes, all corners and flutings, for sticking knives and forks in, which, happily for mankind, are now obsolete. Miss Murdstone gave me her chilly fingernails, and sat severely rigid. Mr. Spenlow shut the door, motioned me to a chair, and stood on the hearthrug in front of the fireplace. "Have the goodness to show Mr. Copperfield," said Mr. Spenlow, "what you have in your reticule, Miss Murdstone." I believe it was the old identical steel-clasped reticule of my childhood that shut up like a bite. Compressing her lips in sympathy with the snap, Miss Murdstone opened it, opening her mouth a little at the same time, and produced my last letter to Dora, teeming with expressions of devoted affection. "I believe that is your writing, Mr. Copperfield," said Mr. Spenlow. I was very hot, and the voice I heard was very unlike mine when I said, "It is, sir." "If I am not mistaken,"
said Mr. Spenlow, as Miss Murdstone brought a parcel of letters out of her reticule, tied round with the dearest bit of blue ribbon. "Those are also from your pen, Mr. Copperfield?" I took them from her with the most desolate sensation. And glancing at such phrases at the top as "my ever dearest and own Dora," "my best beloved angel," "my blessed one for ever," and the like, blushed deeply and inclined my head. "No, thank you," said Mr. Spenlow coldly, as I mechanically offered them back to him. "I will not deprive you of them. Miss Murdstone, be so good as to proceed." That gentle creature, after a moment's thoughtful survey of the carpet, delivered herself with much dry unction as follows: "I must confess to having entertained my suspicions of Miss Spenlow in reference to David Copperfield for some time. I observed Miss Spenlow and David Copperfield when they first met, and the impression made upon me then was not agreeable. The depravity of the human heart is such..." "You will oblige me, ma'am," interrupted Mr. Spenlow, "by confining yourself to facts." Miss Murdstone cast down her eyes, shook her head as if protesting against this unseemly interruption, and with frowning dignity resumed, "Since I am to confine myself to facts, I will state them as dryly as I can. Perhaps that will be considered an acceptable course of proceeding. I have already said, sir, that I have had my suspicions of Miss Spenlow in reference to David Copperfield for some time. I have frequently endeavoured to find decisive corroboration of those suspicions, but without effect. I therefore forbore to mention them to Miss Spenlow's father," looking severely at him, "knowing how little disposition there usually is in such cases to acknowledge the conscientious discharge of duty." Mr. Spenlow seemed quite cowed by the gentlemanly sternness of Miss Murdstone's manner, and deprecated her severity with a conciliatory little wave of his hand. "On my return to Norwood, after the period of absence occasioned by my brother's marriage," pursued Miss Murdstone in a disdainful voice, "and on the return of Miss Spenlow from her visit to her friend Miss Mills, I imagined that the manner of Miss Spenlow gave me greater occasion for suspicion than before. Therefore I watched Miss Spenlow closely." Dear, tender little Dora, so unconscious of this dragon's eye. "Still," resumed Miss Murdstone, "I found no proof until last night. It appeared to me that Miss Spenlow received too many letters from her friend Miss Mills, but Miss Mills being her friend with her father's full concurrence," another telling blow at Mr. Spenlow, "it was not for me to interfere. If I may not be permitted to allude to the natural depravity of the human heart, at least I must be permitted so far to refer to misplaced confidence." Mr. Spenlow apologetically murmured his assent. "Last evening, after tea," pursued Miss Murdstone, "I observed the little dog starting, rolling, and growling about the drawing-room, worrying something. I said to Miss Spenlow, 'Dora, what is that the dog has in his mouth? It's paper.' Miss Spenlow immediately put her hand to her frock, gave a sudden cry, and ran to the dog. I interposed and said, 'Dora, my love, you must permit me.' Oh, Chip, miserable spaniel, this wretchedness then was your work. Miss Spenlow endeavoured," said Miss Murdstone, "to bribe me with kisses, workboxes, and small articles of jewellery. That, of course, I pass over. The little dog retreated under the sofa on my approaching him, and was with great difficulty dislodged by the fire irons. Even when dislodged, he still kept the letter in his mouth, and on my endeavouring to take it from him at the imminent risk of being bitten,
He kept it between his teeth so pertinaciously as to suffer himself to be held suspended in the air by means of the document. At length I obtained possession of it. After perusing it, I taxed Miss Spenlow with having many such letters in her possession, and ultimately obtained from her the packet which is now in David Copperfield's hand. Here she ceased, and snapping her reticule again and shutting her mouth, looked as if she might be broken but could never be bent. "You've heard, Miss Murdstone," said Mr. Spenlow, turning to me. "I beg to ask, Mr. Copperfield, if you have anything to say in reply." The picture I had before me, of the beautiful little treasure of my heart, sobbing and crying all night, of her being alone, frightened and wretched then, of her having so piteously begged and prayed that stony-hearted woman to forgive her, of her having vainly offered her those kisses, work-boxes and trinkets, of her being in such grievous distress, and all for me, very much impaired the little dignity I'd been able to muster. I'm afraid I was in a tremulous state for a minute or so, though I did my best to disguise it. "There is nothing I can say, sir," I returned, "except that all the blame is mine." "Dora, Miss Spenlow, if you please," said her father majestically, "was induced and persuaded by me," I went on, swallowing that colder designation, "to consent to this concealment, and I bitterly regret it." "You are very much to blame, sir," said Mr. Spenlow, walking to and fro upon the hearthrug, and emphasizing what he said with his whole body instead of his head, on account of the stiffness of his cravat and spine. "You have done a stealthy and unbecoming action, Mr. Copperfield. When I take a gentleman to my house, no matter whether he's 19, 29, or 90, I take him there in a spirit of confidence. If he abuses my confidence, he commits a dishonourable action, Mr. Copperfield." "I feel it, sir, I assure you," I returned, "but I never thought so before. Sincerely, honestly, indeed, Mr. Spenlow, I never thought so before. I love Miss Spenlow to that extent." "Pooh! Nonsense!" said Mr. Spenlow, reddening. "Pray don't tell me to my face that you love my daughter, Mr. Copperfield." "Could I defend my conduct if I did not, sir?" I returned with all humility. "Can you defend your conduct if you do, sir?" said Mr. Spenlow, stopping short upon the hearthrug. "Have you considered your years and my daughter's years, Mr. Copperfield? Have you considered what it is to undermine the confidence that should subsist between my daughter and myself? Have you considered my daughter's station in life, the projects I may contemplate for her advancement, the testamentary intentions I may have with reference to her? Have you considered anything, Mr. Copperfield?" "Very little, sir, I'm afraid," I answered, speaking to him as respectfully and sorrowfully as I felt. "But pray believe me, I have considered my own worldly position. When I explained it to you, we were already engaged." "I beg," said Mr. Spenlow, more like Punch than I'd ever seen him, as he energetically struck one hand upon the other. I couldn't help noticing that, even in my despair. "That you will not talk to me of engagements, Mr. Copperfield." The otherwise immovable Miss Murdstone laughed contemptuously in one short syllable. "When I explained my altered position to you, sir," I began again, substituting a new form of expression for what was so unpalatable to him, "this concealment into which I am so unhappy as to have led Miss Spenlow had begun. Since I have been in that altered position, I have strained every nerve. I have exerted every energy to improve it. I'm sure I shall improve it in time. Will you grant me time? Any length of time? We are both so young, sir." "You are right," interrupted Mr. Spenlow, nodding his head a great many times and frowning very much. "You are both very young. It's all nonsense. Let there be an end of the nonsense. Take away those letters and throw them in the fire. Give me Miss Spenlow's letters to throw in the fire, and although our future intercourse must, you are aware, be restricted to the commons here, "'We will agree to make no further mention of the past. "'Come, Mr. Copperfield, you don't want sense, "'and this is the sensible course.' "'No. "'I couldn't think of agreeing to it. "'I was very sorry, but there was a higher consideration than sense. "'Love was above all earthly considerations, "'and I loved Dora to idolatry, and Dora loved me. "'I didn't exactly say so.' I softened it down as much as I could, but I implied it, and I was resolute upon it. I don't think I made myself very ridiculous, but I know I was resolute. "'Very well, Mr. Copperfield,' said Mr. Spenlow. "'I must try my influence with my daughter.' Miss Murdstone, by an expressive sound, a long-drawn respiration, which was neither a sigh nor a moan, but was like both, gave it as her opinion that he should have done this at first. "'I must try,' said Mr. Spenlow, confirmed by this support, "'my influence with my daughter. "'Do you decline to take those letters, Mr. Copperfield?' "'For I'd laid them on the table. "'Yes. "'I told him I hoped he wouldn't think it wrong, "'but I couldn't possibly take them from his Murdstone.' "'Nor from me,' said Mr. Spenlow. "'No,' I replied with the profoundest respect, "'nor from him.' "'Very well,' said Mr. Spenlow. "'A silence succeeding, I was undecided whether to go or stay. "'At length I was moving quietly towards the door "'with the intention of saying that perhaps I should consult his feelings best "'by withdrawing, when he said, with his hands in his coat pockets, "'into which it was as much as he could do to get them, "'and with what I should call upon the whole a decidedly pious air, "'You are probably aware, Mr. Copperfield, "'that I am not altogether destitute. "'of worldly possessions, "'and that my daughter is my nearest and dearest relative. "'I hurriedly made him a reply to the effect "'that I hoped the error into which I had been betrayed "'by the desperate nature of my love "'did not induce him to think me mercenary too. "'I don't allude to the matter in that light,' said Mr. Spenlow. "'It would be better for yourself and all of us "'if you were mercenary, Mr. Copperfield.' I mean, if you were more discreet and less influenced by all this youthful nonsense. No, I merely say, with quite another view, you are probably aware I have some property to bequeath to my child. I certainly suppose so. And you can hardly think, said Mr. Spenlow, having experience of what we see in the Commons here every day, of the various unaccountable and negligent proceedings of men in respect of their testamentary arrangements, of all subjects the one on which perhaps the strangest revelations of human inconsistency are to be met with, but that mine are made. I inclined my head in acquiescence. I should not allow, said Mr. Spenlow, with an evident increase of pious sentiment and slowly shaking his head as he poised himself upon his toes and heels alternately, by suitable provision for my child, to be influenced by a piece of youthful folly like the present. It is mere folly, mere nonsense. In a little while it will weigh lighter than any feather, but I might, if this silly business were not completely relinquished altogether, be induced in some anxious moment to guard her from and surround her with protections against the consequences of any foolish step in the way of marriage. Now, Mr. Copperfield, I hope that you will not render it necessary for me to open, even for a quarter of an hour, that closed page in the Book of Life, and unsettle even for a quarter of an hour grave affairs long since composed. There was a serenity, a tranquillity, a calm sunset air about him which quite affected me. He was so peaceful and resigned, clearly had his affairs in such perfect train and so systematically wound up, that he was a man to feel touched in the contemplation of.
I really think I saw tears rise to his eyes from the depth of his own feeling of all this. But what could I do? I could not deny Dora and my own heart. When he told me I had better take a week to consider of what he'd said, how could I say I wouldn't take a week? Yet how could I fail to know that no amount of weeks could influence such love as mine? In the meantime, confer with Miss Trotwood, or with any person with any knowledge of life, said Mr. Spenlow, adjusting his cravat with both hands. Take a week, Mr. Copperfield.